thank you all for coming this evening to our monthly evening Dharma program. It's my great pleasure tonight to introduce my dear, dear, dear Dharma sister, Wendy Morris. And I knew Wendy before I was practicing Dharma at all. I knew her as a performance artist and probably one of the most genuinely imaginative people I had ever met in my whole life. Wendy just continues to always think about things so differently and so freshly, and I don't think I've ever had a conversation with Wendy where I haven't come away really being able to appreciate a different facet of something or a new way for me of thinking about something. So I just really treasured the many years of conversations that I've had with Wendy. And she's also been a great, great inspiration to me as a practitioner. She has many, many, many years of practice, and Wendy was always an example to me of someone who was really able to integrate practice in her life and see how, no matter what was going on, this was a place to really explore what it meant to be wholehearted and to be present. And I just remember Dharma talks that she gave here. I think one was called like on being like a cow or having the mind of a cow shortly after she'd given birth to Izzy. It was nursing a wonderful talk about that experience. And she gave a great talk years ago on equanimity that I just happened to have the tape with me when I found out we'd been robbed. And they put Wendy in the car driving back to see what it, and it just made such a difference in my ability to be with that. So Wendy just is a real treasure in our community. She has been involved in the program for parents and children here, which has been a program now that is in its third or fourth year now.
I think it's probably in about its fourth year at Common Ground, but we had been meeting in people's homes for about 2 or 3 years before that.
And it's been a wonderful addition to Common Ground, having these really 6 to 10-year-old practitioners here doing projects, and they've done the flag that's outside. If you go down near the library, there's some things that they've done. And Wendy just had a lot of imagination and enthusiasm for, again, seeing how the Dharma just creatively unfolds. Most recently, Wendy has been involved in a really challenging program, this Dharma and Diversity Project, in which she has, working with some other people, has really supported in amazingly tangible and in incredibly intangible ways practitioners of color, helping to raise money to enable people of color to go to people of color Dharma retreats. And she was instrumental in being on the steering committee of a recent program that was held at Clouds and Water in July about the Dharma and, or maybe it was June, Dharma and Diversity project. Again, all of those sorts of issues about the Dharma and the scope of the Dharma and how it really speaks to people's suffering in many, many different sorts of ways. So I look forward to Wendy's talk tonight, and just it's such a wonderful gift to have her in our community. She is truly a treasure and an inspiration. So now you get to live up to that, Wendy.
The phrase that came to mind was, ditto. Are there people here who have never been to Common Ground before? Is there anyone who's new? Okay, a special welcome to you. Special welcome. The bathroom's downstairs. There's water outside. And I'll be talking for about 45, 50 minutes, and then we'll have some question and answer time or comment time. And then there'll be some tea and treats in the other room. So the topic for this evening is I'm seeing life clearly. And Mark, who is the guiding teacher at Common Ground, the first time Mark had asked me, invited me to give a talk here, which was many years ago, I don't know, 7, 8 years ago, he suggested, I said, well, what? I don't know what to talk about. And he said, well, why don't you talk about how you're practicing these days? And so whenever I have an opportunity to give a talk, that's where I turn to, which is, okay, how am I practicing these days? Which is actually something very, very insightful that's embedded in that question, which is the understanding that we practice in different ways, in different cycles of our spiritual life. So I'm going to be talking a little bit about in different cycles of my seasons, in different seasons of my own spiritual life, what it has meant to be seeing life clearly. I remember sort of one season of my spiritual life was a lot about formal meditation practice. I logged a lot of hours of tush on the cush, sitting still in silence. I remember having such zeal to practice that all of my friends were going to have a big celebration one evening down by the river, and I said, oh no, I don't want to go because I'm going to stay home so that I can wake up at 5 in the morning and sit by myself. And for several years, that was the passion that I brought. And I sat, you know, at least an hour a day for years, and often more than that. I'd go to 3 or 4 retreats a year, 5 to 9 days at a time. And when I would come back from retreat, I had this habit, a skillful habit, where I would, whenever I got in the car, I would put a Dharma tape in the cassette player. So that the way my life went was every transition was a Dharma talk. And then when I would arrive at my destination, I would consider that another opportunity to pay attention. Whether I was going to the grocery store, or to a meeting, or to a rehearsal, or a dance class. And then afterwards, I'd get back in the car. And the moment of getting back in the car was like a mindfulness bell. Just a reminder, right before I put in the Dharma tape, that what if this life is about paying attention? And I remember the moment of on a cold winter day, getting into the car and feeling the strain of irritation because I couldn't quite get the seatbelt over the big heavy winter coat, or in the hot summer getting into the car and feeling the sticky sensation of the back of my thighs because I was wearing shorts, just sort of squeaking onto the warm leather seat. And in that season of practice, seeing life clearly just meant noticing the bare sensation. And that's the first foundation of mindfulness, is awareness of just the feeling tone in the body without pushing or pulling on the flow of that reality. Those years turned out to be very, very helpful preparation for parenting. That my experience of parenting with that early year of parenting was that it was like one very long meditation retreat. with a teacher who was extremely rigorous and would not let me slack off at 24 hours a day. I don't know if other people have been able to sustain having a baby and being able to have a sitting practice, but I on the cushion, but I couldn't. What I could do, thankfully, was notice that the very chop wood, carry water activities of being with a little one were a very immediate opportunity to be mindful. Noticing the irritation of, you know, the sensation of opening the diaper and the poop on my hand and the irritation arising. Noticing the delight of sitting down and feeding her. Noticing the physical activity of carrying, of putting down. All of that is like the classic sort of Zen phrase, chop wood, carry water, an opportunity to notice, which I found much easier than my everyday life prior to early parenting, which was talking on the phone and going to meetings, and where I would get more easily lost in my stories. So during that season, seeing clearly meant cultivating a balanced heart and mind and a kind of equanimity. I think that was around the time that I was that phrase that was sort of like transition from that milk mind season of practice to the equanimity season of practice. I literally made dog tags that I'd wear around my neck, and one of them said, heir of this karma, H-E-I-R, inheritance, I will inherit my actions. Heir of this karma, things are just as they are. May I remain lovingly undisturbed by the comings and goings of phenomena. And in the moment when I would be sort of about to get lost in, you know, I want to get out the door, I think I have to go someplace. This is when my daughter is choosing not to decide that she is not ever going to put on a coat again. Before I lose my balance of heart and mind, I would literally grab hold of my dog tag, which was like grabbing hold of my mind, and remember myself. Heir of this karma, how I act in this moment, I will receive the fruits of that action. Things are just as they are. May I remain lovingly undisturbed by the comings and goings of phenomena. So in that season, seeing clearly meant seeing with a balanced heart and mind, even in the midst of my daughter's storms, my storms, my husband's storms. This was amazing practice. I'm so grateful that I had the causes and conditions that allowed me to log a lot of hours on the cushion before going into parenting practice. Because by the time I started my relationship with my daughter, I had enough of that. That relationship then became an extension of the kind of attention that we develop on the cushion. And I don't know if this happens for other parents, but the seasons of my own spiritual life somehow seem to parallel the changes in my daughter's development. And the next season of practice happened very suddenly. And I remember I was sitting, I think, in the seat that Kyoko's in right now. I was sitting there just one summer afternoon, and all of a sudden a thought arose in my mind as I was sitting. Dwell in the space between the question and the answer. I have no idea where that thought came from, but it seemed fairly intriguing at the moment. Dwell in the space between the question and the answer. And as I began to look into that, by asking a question and then dwelling the space before anything else came up, what began to unfold was a way of paying attention by inquiring, by asking questions. Asking, what is happening right now? And that's what I want to address tonight, is how I've been practicing in this, what has seemed like it's gone on for probably about about two years now, this season of inquiry. And how inquiry helps me to see life clearly. My approach to inquiry really sits pretty firmly on the foundation of those years of exploring the first foundation of mindfulness of this body, right now noticing, as you're sitting here, how much weight is on one side of your pelvis compared to the other side. At the moment when you're sitting here, what is the curve of your spine, and can you feel that? Maybe yes, maybe no. So for me, inquiry sits on this foundation of mindfulness of the body, of the breath, of bare attention, just hearing, just feeling, just seeing in the space before we name our experience. Hearing, seeing, feeling, my head nodding, thinking what to say next, thinking, feeling my hands touching one another, feeling the tension in my neck, tension in my eye, seeing your face, silence. Seeing, feeling the light smile coming across my face, confusion, feeling my eyes, these eyes. This is a quote from Patrick Kearney, a Vipassana teacher. The complete instruction for the practice is be aware. How can I be aware all the time? But what can I do to be aware? How can I be aware all the time? I can't. But what I can do is be aware now. I can be aware of anything, including the fact that I'm no longer aware. That moment of confusion just then. That was my line. That wasn't Patrick Kearney. It's back to Patrick Kearney. To be clearly aware of my distraction is awareness. It is the practice itself. One of my teachers used to say, there are no distractions. Note, this is Patrick Kearney again. Note that what I am not doing as I investigate my distractions is looking at the content of the mind. What I am doing is looking at the process of the mind. If I realize that I'm daydreaming about something, I'm not interested in what the daydream is about. That's completely and utterly irrelevant. What I am interested in is simply the fact of daydreaming. The root meditation practice that I've learned and that we do here at Common Ground is Vipassana, or insight meditation. And it's in the Pali language, which was the language that the Buddha's teachings were first recorded in. Vipassana comes from the root word of pas, which means to see. Pasana means seeing, and that prefix vipassana, means separation. So in other words, Vipassana, this practice is about seeing separately and distinctly and penetratingly. Usilananda says it means seeing in various ways. I honestly wasn't thinking about that when the phrase came up for this talk of seeing life clearly. I chose that title because I've had some astonishingly humble moments over the past year where I got to see very clearly how much suffering I cause myself and others when I'm living out and acting out of my own deluded perceptions. I think Patrice referenced the Dharma Diversity Project. And that has been an amazing opportunity for me to see my own delusions from moment to moment, to see the way I am bathed in constructs and opinions and stories about everything. It's also given me the opportunity this year, these moments of, oh my goodness, that's really how I'm seeing things. I mean, I really honestly believe that other people should live in such a way as to make my life easier. I really believe that. And is that true? How do I react when I'm actually acting out of that belief? Other people should make their choices and live their lives to make my life easier. How do I treat them? It's been quite astonishing. And in those moments, occasionally, when I'm able to see sort of that I'm filtering what's going on through an interpretation of some distorted belief like that, what happens is this surprising relief and joy and this sense of suspected possibility that there's a whole different way to be living this life. Perhaps there's a way of living that isn't about trying to control things and manage the world. Perhaps there's a way of living this life that isn't about always trying to shape conditions to meet my preconditions of how I think they should be. Welcome. Perhaps there's a way of living that's about discovering really what's true and relating to this constant unfolding of what's going on as if it's an adventure, this living day to day, moment to moment. While I was reflecting on this talk earlier this week, I asked myself, okay, what does it mean to see life clearly in this moment? And then I just sat in the space between that question and an answer. And what I noticed was the texture of a tear rolling down my face and dropping off my chin. I noticed, which was the sound of the dryer. I noticed, which was the music that had been coming up through the floor that I would have sworn wasn't there a moment ago, but I suspect it was, and I just hadn't noticed. There was an orange picture of two Balinese dancers on the other side of the room, and perception shifted. And what became apparent was, rather than two Balinese dancers on the other side of the room in a picture, there was a white wall with a picture on it of two orange Balinese dancers. That may sound like a subtle difference, but subtle is significant. The difference from noticing what's foreground to noticing the whole that the experience exists within. So why does it matter if I know whether or is going on, or whether sadness is present or not? I came across this research from my alumni newsletter from college about how one's circumstances and mood impact moral behavior. So I'm going to ask you to take a moment and think about your friends. And if someone dropped a file of papers on the street, which one of your friends, just silently to yourself, which one of your friends would be most likely to pick up the papers? Wrong. According to this research that was quoted from this philosopher at Washington University, about the work of John Darley, a psychology professor at Princeton. There's some pretty trivial seeming factors that influence what people do morally. And by moral behavior, for example, you're more likely to help the paper dropping scenario if the ambient noise is at a normal level than if there's a lawnmower going on. And let's say you need to get change for a dollar. You're more likely to get it if you ask in front of a bakery or a coffee shop than in front of someplace like a tire store, because the aroma perks your mood up, and that influences how you want to engage and behave in the world. So, and going back to the paper dropping scenario, that a person is more likely to help if they're in a good mood. Let's say they just found a quarter in the phone booth, than if they stepped on a wad of bubblegum, regardless of any innate or perceived individual sort of level of morality. Sound arising. So much of Buddha Dharma is being confirmed by all of this research around sort of human behavior and personality. We are not fixed selves. How we experience life is a constellation of influences, external factors, moods. We know that from those of us who sit. I mean, one of my teachers described being on retreat. For days, she felt like this intense irritation. She's playing out her life story, and this is intense. And then she noticed at the end of like the second day that the waistband on her pants was too tight, and it was influencing. Like, there was this irritation looking for an object to attach to, and her mind was like scanning the horizon, finding every object to attach to that could support this irritation. So, what does all this have to do with seeing clearly? Right. Our actions and our behaviors are influenced by our moods and our external factors, the ones that we're not tracking. The smell of the tires, barking dog, the tight waistband. I've been experimenting with inquiry as a practice, as I said, over the past few years, and I've discovered that much more than I ever dreamt, that my mood is pretty much determined, as well as by these external factors, by my thoughts and by the stories and the interpretations I have for any given situation. And one of my most pervasive stories is, in any unpleasant situation, get ready, it's not supposed to be like this. It's not supposed to be like this. And I really believe it's not supposed to be like this. One of my teachers, I've been studying a lot, when I talk about inquiry, the work of Byron Katie, who's a real master of inquiry, and also David Gorman, who's a very similar sort of inquiry process. And Byron Katie defines God as, God is reality. In other words, the barking dog, the tight waistband, the thoughts, it shouldn't be like, you know, that basically, this God is reality. And when you fight with God, you lose, but only 100% of the time. And I know, because I've spent a lot of time fighting with God in all different manifestations, in all different ways. And for a long time, I mean, I don't know how I say this. Why would you want to see life clearly anyway? You know, what if seeing life clearly isn't pretty? What if it's not comfortable? What if it's not comforting? What if seeing life clearly means seeing groundlessness everywhere? What if seeing life clearly means that there's no lasting anything, and everything that arises passes away, and there's no fixed person that all this is happening to, and that even if I get all this stuff I think I want, that I'm still not going to be happy, because by the time I get it, I won't want it anyway, or even if I do get it, it's not going to last, and once I get it, I'm going to want something else instead. In other words, What if seeing life clearly means recognizing what the Buddha described as the three characteristics of all conditioned phenomena? Anicca, that everything that arises passes away, that life is change. Anatta, that there is no solid, enduring self, that we are a construct, a combination, a melding of form, feeling, perceptions, mental formations, consciousness. And dukkha, which is often translated as suffering or unsatisfactoriness, that there is no lasting fundamental satisfaction in any conditioned phenomenon because it's all changing. That's its nature. Who would want to see clearly if that's what we're going to see? And I've asked that question a lot in my practice. Why would I want to see that? Even if it is what's real, why would I want to know that? Why would I want to give up my delusions? That I can really make, I can manage this life. I can manage it. I got it under control. Why would I want to give up that delusion? Well, according to the Buddha, it's because there's a possibility for freedom from this deluded mess, and that there's a path that the Buddha exquisitely outlined for us. The Dhammapada begins, "Mind is the forerunner of all things. Think or act with a corrupted, sick, deluded mind, and suffering will follow like the wheel on the cart that follows the hoof of the ox. Think or act with a pure mind, clear mind, and happiness will follow you unshakable like a shadow." In other words, if I am thinking or acting from delusion, there's no way I'm going to be happy. I looked up some synonyms for the words delusion. Misconception, misapprehension, misunderstanding, misinterpretation, misconstruction, misbelief, fallacy, error, mistake, self-deception, illusion, false impression, myth, bubble, hallucination, vision, mirage, dream, apparition, chimera, fancy, phantasm, phantasmagoria, and specter. So, I'm going to talk about a fight I had with my husband last week that was a really lovely example of that. I was so caught and so triggered, and I was completely locked into this self-protective story, and I was suffering from it, but I knew it. And sometimes just when I'm in the middle of a moment like that, just turning towards it is enough for it to let go. This wasn't one of those moments. So what I did was I just sort of invented something on the fly. I was in the middle of this fight, and I was just about to lash out, and mindfulness arose. I heard the tone of my voice getting more brittle and sharp. I literally felt my body draw back like an archer who's about to release an arrow. Honestly, I went, okay, this one, I'm just like, I'm going to really zing this one here, and then he's going to know how bad I feel. And in the moment of, I had a thought, okay, is there another option? And what arose was the thought, the question, silently, what am I grateful for right now in this moment? Now, I did not want to answer that. I didn't want to turn towards that question. I was, because turning towards that question would have meant, in an instant, giving up that self-protected, angry stance. And I didn't want to. And I was thinking about this. I was thinking, what is that I don't want to? And I was thinking, perhaps my resistance to turning towards that question, what am I grateful for now, right here, in this moment, is because some part of me knows and understands that that stance of outrage that can seem so solid and so viable and so self-reinforcing is actually made up of a pretty shaky set of concepts. It's not as solid as it seems. It's like a house of cards. It's a phantasm. It's a chimera. It's a bubble of delusion that can be popped in an instant. And because I want to be free, I ask the question. I just silently and there's this like timeless moment of nothing. And I think it was not perceptible to my husband at all that any of this was going on. And that question arose, what am I grateful for in this moment right now? And then what came up was, I'm grateful that I care enough about my own happiness to ask that question. And this compassion arose for myself, this confused self that gets so caught up and wants to lash out. And then I returned to the fight. But something was a little softer, just a hair's breadth less rabid. But again, in the life of practice, subtle is significant. And my husband doesn't know any of this. Because it's my own heart and mind that I'm caring for. And that in that moment, it's my own heart and mind that I'm taking responsibility for. It's got nothing to do with him. Here's a quote. I used to think the brain was the most fascinating part of the body. Then I thought, look what's telling me that. That's how I've been living the past year. That's Emo Phillips, comedian Emo Phillips. Is just noticing, what am I believing? Who am I believing? What am I believing? You know, as Patrice was saying, over the past year, I was one of 9 members of the steering committee that produced the first Buddhist meditation retreat for people of color in the upper Midwest, in this region. And I'll tell you, there's nothing like addressing issues of race in the context of Dharma to help a white girl come face to face with her delusions. You know, our first public event was one of the most challenging days of my life. I had no idea. I had so many assumptions of how things were supposed to go until they didn't go the way that I thought they were supposed to. And, you know, I was so convinced internally that if things didn't go the way I thought they should go, that there would be some unspeakable disaster. And instead, everything went about as, there's a phrase in Chinese, luan qi ba zao, which is like sixes and sevens. Everything was like, it makes no sense. Everything was sixes and sevens. And it made no sense in the way I thought it should make sense. And I had a very strong story. It shouldn't be this way. I really was believing that. To the point where I didn't notice that the whole thing went really well. And that people really connected with one another. And they had a really good time. And it was a great foundation for what we were trying to do. I was so lost in my story that the process didn't go the way I thought it should, that it took me days to recognize the reality that this had just been fine. And that's a been, over the past year, just there have been so many, many opportunities to notice that. That in a given situation, I'm seeing things through the filter of how I think they're supposed to be rather than how they are. And one very strong component of that filter is what one of my colleagues, John Powell, who used to teach at the university, the Center for Race and Poverty, and used to practice at Common Ground, has had a long time Dharma practice. He gave a talk, and what I was talking about, this component of this filter of how I'm seeing things, is what John calls white space. And John gave a talk. Did anyone hear the talk that John gave at Clouds and Water in May? It's on the Clouds and Water Zen Center website, and it's was very, very inspiring to me. And so I'm going to share part of it with you. The concept, this is from John Powell, the concept of self in modern society is already racialized. The individual, separate, autonomous self is a racialized construct. And he talks about the historical parallel development of the modernized sense of self, this autonomous, separate being, and the concept of the concepts of race. White space is not the same as this John. White space is not the same as white people. In this society, we all live in this white space. It's a space that's born of fear. The sort of racial other is, that construct of racial other is based and rooted in fear. Everything is afraid in white space. And he talks about Hobbes as one of the most important political philosophers in modern Western society, about Hobbes's view and ideas about society as a scary place where everybody wants to take your stuff. And so we should create a sovereign state to police our relationships with one another, because all of you are scary and you all just want my stuff. So therefore we need guns and private property to wall us off from one another, because you're all scary. So we also need to institutionalize our separateness. This is white space, the space where whiteness was given birth, this fear, this fearful construct of the world. And the fear of the racial other, this is where the racial other was given birth, people of African descent, or Indian descent, Asian descent, people who are likely to be organized more around a collective sense of self, and an interconnected sense of self, where the racialized other is, that's sort of like, it's so from that, how do I say this, that is so much to be feared and disdained that, I mean, that was part of the reason why native land could be that Europeans could rationalize taking native land, because it was owned collectively. And what civilized people would possibly own collective property? So John talks about Hobbes' notion of this society as one of extreme fear. And how do we deal with that? How do we manage this world? How do we manage the earth? How do we manage the racial other? How do we manage other individuals? And his vision was that we manage it by retreating to private property, to private space, to separation, to the autonomous individual self, to guns, to protecting ourselves from all others, especially the racialized other. In other words, we're cut off. And then how do you manage the racial other? Largely through space. Segregation is just another word for separation. What racism, this is John, what racism suggests is that not only am I not my brother and sister's keeper, but I am not my brother or sister's brother or sister. And I would add that I am not my brother. I am not my sister. So the Dharma Diversity Project, being involved with that, has been the cutting edge of my practice. It's been the place where I really have had the chance to see my own delusions, my own assumptions about white space, about separation, so clearly that occasionally they actually let go and I get a glimpse of another way of living. that really is about, I am your brother, I am your sister. The gift of the work that we've been doing over the past 2 years has changed every part of my life. And especially the need for a self-protective separation that I just assumed. And that's where that I think more than anything else, the title for this talk about seeing life clearly has come out of that work that I've been doing over the past couple of years. Because I think I've had glimpses of really seeing through this pervasive cultural delusion of race, of this fearful white space, this fear-based white space, and this glimpse of a way of living that does it's fundamentally aligned with our Dharma practice, with our Buddhist, with what the Buddha described as really the way things are, that we are interconnected. So by engaging in this work, I'm actually beginning to explore what are alternative ways of constructing institutions and the society, of contributing to social systems that aren't based on that deluded, separate, fear-based white space. I want to conclude with a poem and a question. So I'm going to read the poem, and then I'm going to ask you a question, and I'm going to invite you just to dwell in the space between the question and any answer that might or might not arise. Okay, so I'll read the poem first, and then I'll ask the question, and invite you just to notice the space between any question and your answer. And this is, the poem is What Issa Heard, and Issa was a prominent Japanese haiku poet. And it's by David Budd Bill. He was a prominent Japanese haiku poet, so in the 1800s. "200 years ago, Issa heard the morning birds singing sutras to the suffering world. I heard them too this morning, which must mean, since we will always have a suffering world, we must also always have a song." Read it again. 200 years ago, Issa heard the morning birds singing sutras to the suffering world. And sutras are like the Buddhist texts, the Buddhist teachings. I heard them too this morning, which must mean, since we will always have a suffering world, we must also always have a song. The question: where in the midst of a suffering world do you find a song? Leave that and just take a few minutes now just to talk about any things that you heard that particularly were resonant for you in your intention to see life clearly, as well as any other comments, questions. I'm curious about what is resonant for you of what I've talked about this evening.
I particularly particularly appreciated hearing you share about your delusion. I guess mostly in context of, expecting the world fit the way you think it ought to be. And also how surprised you were. I can't remember what you said, but for me, what it resonated with is, I feel like when I see clearly, I really see how profoundly self-centered I am. And there's, where I most of the times, I'm like, well, I'm a pretty good guy, or whatever it is, the self-image that I have. And so when I see that, and I see, wow, it really seems, at least as deeply as I've seen, I'm really a pretty self-centered person. And to see that, and it kind of hurts. It doesn't really quite match with the person I'd like to be. Mm-hmm. And, but then there is just something, there is some freedom there. It's just something just like, it's very humbling. And then there's this dropping of the story. But mostly, that's really how, when I feel like I'm seeing things clearly, I don't look that good. Just nice. I really appreciate you sharing.
Uh-huh. Thank you, Matt. Thank you. Thinking about that metaphor of the seasons and the way summer always keeps coming around, but it's not quite the same summer. And so, I think that within that, there are periods of time within that or seasons, like mini seasons, that are so much about bare attention and, So I think there's it's almost like spirals of things that just appear again and again, but I, so I'll be curious, the same thing, to watch as my own practice unfolds, how those spirals, what recycles in a new form, what summer returns again, what spring returns.
I was impressed with the seasonal parenting, early parenting, and the awareness that you brought to everything. And I'm wondering if that's possible without having had that real dedicated years of tushan kush, as you said. his, and then the next season, but I wonder, can you get there without taking all that time to do the first foundation? I want to get going.
You know, I think so much, everyone's practice unfolds so differently. And I think there's some people who, I think, do enter parenting, and the heart opening of this relationship brings them so much to the present moment that mindfulness arises. It's so much for me about practice. It's really about learning how to live with this particularly, the way this particular heart and mind are constructed. And, this particular heart and mind tends to be fairly agitated and not very chop wood, carry water. So I think for me, it was really helpful to have that foundation. For someone else, I remember Kamala saying, you know, I'm very simple. You know, and I think for her parenting, Kamala Masters, who comes and teaches here every summer, so I'm senior meditation teachers, Vipassana teachers in the West, and Kamala talks about, she didn't do a lot of on-the-cushion practice. Her practice, she had four children, she was a single mom, she was working full-time, and her practice developed when she walked in the hallway from one child's bedroom to the other, or this hallway she describes, I don't know if it was from the bedrooms, and while she was washing dishes, and that's really where her practice blossomed. And she describes that was, so I think we all have, learning to live with the particular heart and mind. And this particular mind is very complicated. And so for me, actually, inquiry, it's been using what, it's like the thorn. It's like, for me, using the thorn of this particular mind that can complicate any situation and spin, to use that as the actual sort of cleaning out the wound. The same thorn, using that to clean out the wound of delusion.
Thank you so much for your talk. Really wonderful. When you started, I misunderstood you. I thought you changed the title from Seeing Life Clearly to Seeing Life Dearly. How wonderful. Maybe you repeat it. And what I heard, Andy, that you went through the talk, was Seeing Life Dearly.
Thank you, Craig.
Listen to you go on and on about the dearness of your life.
It's a lot prettier from the outside, believe me.
not more precious.
Yeah, not more precious and not more dear.
The thing that resonated with me when you ask the question, do I want to see life clearly? And, isn't it easier to live in delusion? And, I don't want to admit this, but I have to ask myself the same question every day, because I can escape, clarity. I mean, I choose to escape many little escapes without any drugs or alcohol. And so it's a great question. Thank you.
I also resonated to asking, asking myself, why do I believe I'm the delusion of permanency? Why do I want to deconstruct myself? Why? And over the years, seeing the consequence of not doing that, when seeing the consequence of hanging on and how seeing over and over, it does really create suffering. And though a phrase, by little, the practice through awareness, you let go, and you see the glimpses of freedom here and here, and that
thank you for the Dharma talk. I'm inspired. So, talk on. Thank you all.